Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 14 of season 9 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we pick our way through the Die Hard duo, the last two Die Hard movies, Die Hard 4 and 5, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Nick Rehack of the Rabbit Hole podcast. So welcome back to the show again, Nick.
Hey, thank you, Rob, for having me once again.
Yeah, I hope your ears aren't ringing too much from those very close quarter shots that John has to endure.
It's funny you say that, because recently, and by recently, I mean as of this recording date, 3 days ago, I was at a shooting range, and I, very poorly and very not being respectful myself, did not wear the proper ear protection. And I've been having some hearing trouble the last 2 days. So we're finally at a place where I feel normal again. But I was very disappointed in myself that I didn't use protection, because I'm thinking like, oh, I'm fine, I've done it before. No, I've reached this age now where I need hearing protection. Immediately went out and bought protection and everything. So I'm good to go moving forward. But it's funny you kind of bring that up.
Were you indoors or outdoors?
Outdoors.
Oh, okay. All right. Because I was going to say, if you're indoors, they're going to make you. You know, make sure.
Oh, yeah. No, indoors would have been a no brainer. But here I'm thinking I'm outdoors. Oh, it's going to be fine because it's outside. No, Nick, you were wrong.
Okay, it happens. There are worse things out there, especially since, you know, if you said it's been 3-4 days and the ringing's gone down, so you should be fine.
It's true. That is true.
From that perspective. But but John is probably a lot closer. Than you were.
Oh, yeah.
And again, he's indoors as opposed to outdoors.
In a stairwell, too, with that. So that sound is very, very tight.
That's true. So episode 14 begins with John going blow for blow with the henchmen and ends with John seeing a filming our site. So basically, as we just said, John and the henchmen started shot at one another, and now they begin to fight between the two of them to both them trying to get the upper hand. They go punch for punch. John punches him, he punches him back. You know, some of the stuff that happens here is really reminiscent of what happens between John and Tony in the original Die Hard, you know, right before Tony falls down the stairs. I'm very curious if this action scene was choreographed to look similar to it.
Have like a couple winks and nods. I wouldn't be surprised, because we do get a really interesting moment here where as he goes to spin around on a henchman, he grabs his side holster, shoots him in the foot, and then comes around. Right. So I thought that moment was really interesting. But definitely there, I feel like especially with the fight sequences, there's moments that harken back to the previous films. So I think you're onto something.
Yeah, because again, it looks like he's about to fall down a flight of stairs, you know.
Yeah.
But like you said, John is able to grab the gun now. Now, my question is the guy just shot his gun. He has a second gun that's holstered?
Yeah, I guess as a backup, you know, or something ready to go.
Well, I mean, again, we see that he does have a shoulder holster. So I guess he pulled out the gun from the shoulder holster, and now he had one, you know, on his side holster.
So he's got all kinds of guns.
Yeah, but again, that's something that's also going to be reused later in this movie. The idea of, mm-hmm. You know, pulling the trigger on someone's holstered gun and shooting him.
Ah, yes.
Which again will show us the connections between like father, like daughter. So yeah, gotta watch out for those things. It's hereditary.
It is.
And then John pulls his gun out, and then the goon pulls out a knife, you know, and then John just shoots him.
Yeah, well, at that point, what are you going to do?
That's right. And you'd think that John would make a comment about, you know, no one brings a knife to a gunfight, but he doesn't.
Yeah, nothing. Not even to Matthew, as they're both going up the steps. Like, at any point, he could have said, see, this is why you don't bring a knife to a gunfight, and then off they go, but...
That's right.
Wasted opportunity.
Maybe they felt that it was copyrighted already by Connery, and they didn't want to repeat that, you know, even though it fits perfectly in here.
Maybe.
And then John decides that they're gonna keep going up the stairs, and he taps Farrell and says, "Come on, let's go, let's go." And he goes, "All right." And the two of them start climbing up the steps, and then we see the second goon trying to figure out where he needs to go, and he's not really sure, and then he veers off to the left, and then we're back in the FBI command center. And we see Molina, and Molina says, "Intel's fairly certain that terrorists are mobile. It's the only way to consistently avoid signal triangulation. And judging by the amount of hardware they're running, we're probably looking for a large vehicle, most likely a semi-trailer rig." So again, that's pretty astute to figure that all
Yeah.
out. But again, it goes back to all the techie jargon that they do here, where we don't really need to, it just sounds a little too mechanical the way that he's talking about it.
Yeah, almost a little too cold.
That's right.
Like,
That's
they're
right.
obviously the good guys, because there's times in a film where, sure, they want to portray a government agency or a higher up agency as, like, are they the good guys? Are they the bad guys? So they have them speak in a certain manner. But clearly, this group that we're following, that we're with, are the good guys, are the ones that we are on the side with, because John's already interfaced with them. He's already talked to them and said, "Hey, what do we need to do? Let's go figure it out." So for them to continue to talk like that's like an interesting choice. And maybe it's something that they thought of, maybe it's something they didn't think of. But, like you said, it is something that, like, you kind of notice and pick up on.
Exactly. And then Bowman looks at him and responds and says, "All right, tell the guys at Homeland Security we need every agent, satellite, and functioning network they got now." I love in movies how they're so forceful that they need something now.
How do we get the sense of urgency across? Let's say now.
That's right. And
What
they
about
give
ASAP? Get him out of here. We're saying now.
That's right. And we get a little gratuitous shot of the two suits that they brought in, including Tim Russ from Star Trek, who have nothing to do in this entire movie, but they give us a little shot of them, just to let you know that they're paying attention to what's going on. Maybe something's going to happen later, but spoiler alert, nothing happens with these guys later.
But
They just
it plays
disappear.
into right it but it plays into what we just kind of talked about, in that, like, these government agencies, are they good guys, are they bad guys? And they kind of leave you with that, like, they might be bad guys, so let's keep a distance.
That's right. And then we get another shot of Mai continuing to hack. She's to type some stuff on that cool keyboard. And now we see that the Reds are beating the Greens in the state of West Virginia.
All of a sudden, we're a sports podcast.
That's right. And then on the screen we get a little shot that says power grid manual override, 95% power generators ready for shutdown. So, but there isn't 95% that has been, closed off to red.
No, their numbers are weird. Unless they're, t un unless they mean like 95% isn't like the size of, like, the ones that are red. Are like, hey, this makes up 95% of everything on the screen. But if that's the case, then you got to redo some math or zones or charts or something, because that doesn't make any sense.
That's right. And then she's looking at the screen and we see more reds popping up, and we get a shot of the fact that her gun is on the side. They let us know that, and then something pops up on the screen underneath what was already said about the power grid, and then it says proceed, yes or no. And at this point, she should have said, "You bet your ass, I want to proceed."
Where's that third option?
That's right. Again, it to me this seems like a callback to the original diary. Where's Theo when you need him?
Yeah,
Said
yeah.
you said you get my. And then as she's continuing to hack and clicks on the yes, she hears something and quickly grabs her gun. And then we hear McClane say, "Playtime's over, sweetheart." And he goes, "Don't take the hand off the gun." So it's very funny that John calls her sweetheart. So, do you know what the term sweetheart actually means?
I don't, but I'm honestly, and this is going to sound even weirder, I'm actually curious because I call my daughter sweetheart. I don't call anybody else sweetheart except for her. And I think it's a deliberate thing that I did. So I'm hoping what you're about to tell me is like a really positive thing, or I'm gonna have to change it up really quick.
No, that you don't have to worry about.
All right,
It's
good.
positive. It's positive. So, sweetheart is a term of endearment often applied to a loved one or a person who demonstrates a significant amount of kindness. So that definitely doesn't fit with my.
No, not at all.
But it's very very interesting that he tries to use that phrase. So sweetheart can also be a part of other phrases. You have the idea of a childhood sweetheart. It's a reciprocating phrase for a relationship, but not a partnership between young persons. This may
Okay.
come about by an extension of friendship, physical attraction, or develop from natural affinity. The relationship is usually platonic and lasts short to medium periods of time. The experience forms the basis of subsequent future relationships later in childhood or in adulthood. Usually, an individual will have no more than one childhood sweetheart, as this term is indicative of the milestone in the growth, development, and maturity of a young person. In ideal circumstances, the term applies mutually to both parties and corresponds both ways, hence the plural being childhood sweethearts. The relationship may involve romantic love or may be an extension of a close friendship. Often, intimacy by way of kissing will occur in order to show affection. This is in addition to hugging, cuddling, holding hands, etc. The term first love may also apply in certain situations. Occasionally, in later years, these friendships are rekindled following separation or passing of their adult partners, which leads to a later life marriage, union, etc. These
Oh,
instances are
wow.
notable as they are made popular by media coverage.
I was going to say, now we're in movie territory.
That's right. Very much. So there's also the phrase a sweetheart deal. You know what that would mean?
I hear it all the time at work, but it's not clicking with me right now. I would assume a deal that like both parties benefit. Or something that's like, man, we're really either this person's really making out really well, or we're making out really well.
Okay, so the it's it sort of that. So a sweetheart deal is or a sweetheart contract is a contractual agreement, usually worked out in secret, that greatly benefits some of the parties while inappropriately disadvantaging other parties or the public at large. The term was coined in the 1940s to describe corrupt labor contracts that were favorable to the employer rather than the workers, and usually involved some kind of kickback or special treatment for the labor negotiator. The term is also applied to special arrangements between private corporations and government entities, whereby the corporation and sometimes a government official reap the benefits rather than the public. No-bid contractors may be awarded to people who have political connections or make donations to influential politicians. Sometimes a sweetheart deal involves tax breaks or other inducements to get a corporation to do business in that city or state. So yeah, it's not 100% positive.
Yeah, that could go either way. Yeah.
Exactly. There's also a candy known as sweethearts. Are you familiar with that candy?
Love sweethearts. Sweethearts. Anything by typically I think like it's the Necco Northeast Candy Confectionery so and so group. Yeah, anything by them, I'm for it.
That's right. So it is they're also known as conversation hearts. They're small heart-shaped sugar candies. Usually sold around Valentine's Day, and each heart is printed with a message such as "Be mine, kiss me, call me, let's get busy, miss you, or I'm yours." Sweethearts were often were made by the New England Confectionery Company or Necco.
Aha!
You were right about
Called
that.
it, called it.
That's right. Before being purchased by Spangler Candy Company in 2018, they were also previously made by the Stark Candy Company. Necco manufactured nearly 8 billion sweethearts
Oh
per year.
my gosh.
Yeah.
And dentists everywhere rejoiced,
Oh,
for the
for
work was there.
sure. Now, how far back do you think the idea of these sweetheart candies go back? When do you think they were first invented, I guess you can say?
I'm going to say like The late 18, I would say 1882, 1883, somewhere in there.
1847.
Whoa, that is much earlier than I thought. Wow.
Yes. So they a man named Oliver Chase started making them in 1847, and they were originally used as lozenges. And then his brother, Daniel Chase, 19 years later, in 1866, decided to start printing sayings on the candies. So he designed a machine that was able to press on the candy, similar to a stamp. The candy was often used for weddings since the candies had witty sayings such as "Married in pink, you will take a drink; married in white, you have chosen right; and married in Satin, love will never be lasting." Oh, sorry, married in satin, love will never be lasting.
Okay, I
Okay,
was about to
I
say
was
that
gonna.
one didn't rhyme, and that's a bit of a bummer.
Yeah. No, but also married in Satan. I don't know about that one.
Yikes.
But thankfully, Satan and Satin are spelled the same way, which means it wasn't that I just misread it.
There
I just mispronounced it. That was
you
it.
go.
They were originally shaped in the shape of seashells. And they
Okay.
used to be larger. And the idea of starting to make them into heart-shaped ones began in 1901.
Really?
When they created the Sweethearts itself.
See, that surprises me because if they're doing that all the way back in the 1840s, how did it take them, nearly 60 years for that to like kick on that way? That's interesting.
Don't know. Yeah. And they started putting really strange things on there. They had fax me, text me. People obviously preferred marry me in
Right,
order
right.
to do that. Yeah, they were making 100,000 pounds of hearts per day, which would sell out in about 6 weeks. They produced 8 billion hearts per year,
Oh my God. That's I
and
still can't get over that.
it is the second popular Valentine candy after chocolate.
All right, that makes sense. But okay, that makes sense. I'd say it's kind of a cheat because you can't just say chocolate as a whole, but then again, you can't get so granular that it's like, oh, chocolate Hershey Kisses versus chocolate that versus chocolate whatever. So,
Right, but they're probably talking about chocolate shaped hearts. That's probably the idea here.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right.
But again, it's different companies and stuff like that. But yeah, and they actually changed the formula in 2010, and they changed the colors and the flavors, and they included sour apple and blue raspberry, and people didn't like it.
Yeah, no. Stick,
And
give us the originals.
8 years later, they declared bankruptcy.
Bummer.
They shouldn't have made those sour apples and blue raspberries.
Nope, that's how they get you.
That's right. And they were bought up by Spangler, Spangler Candy Company, which continued with them. It took them there was about a year where they didn't have them, and then in 2020 they came back with the original flavors.
Nice.
Yes, and the ingredients obviously no one knows the exact formula, but the ingredients are corn syrup, sugar, gelatin, and various types of food coloring. Simple
Yeah, it's about
as
right.
that.
Yeah.
So again, John, wants to give Mai some candy. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, pretty much. Here's some treats.
That's right. And then John says, "Hands up, stand up, go on now." And he turns to Farrell and goes, "Let's go, kid. You're up." And he goes, "Okay." And then Farrell begins to start getting ready to do stuff. And John's a little impatient at this point, and he goes, "As fast as you can, hey." He goes, "Jesus." And Mai, basically is walking backwards with John. John's pulling her backwards, and she looks very docile, as if she's given in. But then she quickly turns around and starts hitting John, and actually grabs his arm and makes him bash himself in the head with the gun, which is quite impressive. And then she She presses on the release button, and the clip falls out, and then she twists around John's arm and shoots the one bullet that was in the chamber, and it comes very, very close to Farrell, and Farrell screams, "Jesus!" John isn't happy because she throws him around the room. He picks up the gun again. She kicks it out of his hand, kicks him into a glass thing. You know,
a lot of kicks,
beating the crap out of John. No question about that. And then John picks himself up and goes, "That's enough of this kung fu shit."
Yeah.
He goes, "I've known some bitches in my day, but you are the biggest." And he runs towards her as he's saying this and tackles her. And Farrell is not happy.
No.
And then John starts kicking her. He kicks her in the face. And again, Farrell is just in shock watching this all happening. And John goes, "Still awake, huh?" And then he turns, as he's punching her, he turns to Farrell and goes, "Just keep doing what you're doing." "Okay." And he goes, "How much time do you need?" "Not much." And John's finally, giving it back to her by just, he swings her around, throws her into a bookcase, grabs a huge lock of hair that was that was connected to her at the time. And he looks at his hand and goes, "Woo!" John is, I think this is the first time we've seen John fight a female in this entire franchise.
It's been aggressive too, but I get it. Like, he's just matching her, or trying to, because she's coming at him again, kicks left and right, and she's throwing him around like a rag doll, like he's nothing.
Then John turns to Farrell, who's still in shock, and goes, "Are you done?" And he goes, "Are you done?" No, not quite. And he goes, "What? I'm not exactly checking my email here, They ran this hack. They ran this hack in VMO, so I'm isolating their API, and just booting the host." John, what? It means about 30 seconds, okay? So, I mean, he mentions some fun things here. First of all, he mentions email. So, do you know when they started using email?
I think email was back in the late 60s, and it was actually, I think it was just like two universities that were sending messages back and forth for like data research or something.
Okay, well, originally, the idea, it started in the 60s, as you said.
All right, no.
And it was the idea of computer-based messaging, that they were being able to send things back and forth via mainframes and mini computers and stuff like that. And they wanted to find a way that they could still contact, have messages between systems that were not really compatible with one another. So they created these mail applications.
Oh, okay.
And in 1971, they created one that was called the ARPANET network. That's when they first started using the idea of using the at symbol or the strudel, or what other names are there for the at sign?
I've always just called it the at symbol.
Yeah. Okay, exactly. They finally figured out a way to send messages over FTP, file transfer protocol, and stuff like that. So in the mid 70s, that's when they started calling it email. What we know of as email, electronic mail.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is it's a very cool idea. That you can send something between systems that don't necessarily, they can't necessarily talk to each other, but they can all just read this exact same thing, sending messages back and forth. Then it became used as a real word in the late 70s, where it was e-dash mail, because at the they got rid of the dash at some point because it made things a little more complicated.
Right.
It was CompuServe made the idea of email much more popular in 1981.
Man, I haven't heard CompuServe in a long time.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. And there are a lot of people that there are a lot of systems that just refer to it as mail. You know, a single piece of electronic mail is called a message. And you have the whole idea of to and from and CC and BCC.
Right.
And all this stuff was thought of in the mid 70s. And then they started, you know, having like a visual envelope and content and things like that. You know, adding a header and a body to the whole thing. So it's just very cool seeing how things developed. Because it eventually, obviously, as of today, there are very few people who don't know what email is. And, you know, most people don't use regular mail. And it's because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've, with my job, I've taken over new responsibilities, and I'm dealing with jurisdictions in other states where we can't upload documents through an online portal. We have to actually mail them things. And I'm glad I grew up when I did, because I couldn't imagine being someone who'd be like, wait, I have to mail this? How do I mail this to someone? And just learning like the proper structure of when you're on an envelope, how, you know, the return address is in the upper left, the one you're sending to is in the center, and then the right goes your stamp and all this other stuff. Like, I couldn't imagine. Oh, I'm sure younger generations now have to go on Google. You have to go online to figure out how to mail something to someone.
Do you have any idea what a VMO is?
Virtual machine something or other. That's I can't think of what the O would be. An operation outlet or something like that. I'm confident on the V and the M part though, not the O.
Okay, so in computing, a VMO typically refers to a vendor management office, a centralized business function focused on managing relationships with third-party vendors.
You know what's embarrassing about that? We use a VMI service with my company. It's vendor managed inventory. So why I didn't just go with that and try to complicate it by making a virtual machine?
Because between O and I, it's
it's a whole world of letters.
That's right. Even though they're next to each other on the keyboard. So yeah. Right. It's also something that's referred to as a value management office.
Okay.
But it's just very funny. He's just throwing out anagrams here. There's nothing. It makes absolutely no sense because
it feels that way sometimes.
Yeah. Because again, if it's a centralized function responsible for defining and implementing an enterprise's vendor management strategy, the activities include vendor selection, contract negotiation, performance management, and risk mitigation. So it just makes no sense with the fact that he says they ran this hack in VMO. So I don't know. Maybe it's something else. It just doesn't. Maybe I mean I wasn't able to find that a VMO is a programming name or something. You know, the other. I mean, I found a bunch of other VMOs, but nothing. You know the Vlaamse Militante Order is the order of Flemish militants. You have Vastus Medalis Oblique, which is a muscle. The maximum operating speed of an aircraft is known as a VMO.
I didn't know that.
VMO are designations of observation squadrons in the Marine Corps. A disclaimer as to the views stated are my own.
Oh. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's in mathematics, it's a vanishing mean oscillation, and it is the visiting medical officer. So again, nothing fits with what he says. He just doesn't run in the VMO. The only thing, because the vendor management office is one that's used in computing, I just assumed that's what he's referring to. But again, it doesn't really make much sense with what he's saying. And then he says, I'm isolating their API. So I looked up what API could be. Do you have any idea what an API here could be?
I know KPI, so I would assume API is like kind of something similar. Let's see, KPI is key performance indicators. So maybe some kind of program indicator, advanced program indicator.
Close. It's an application programming interface.
Okay. I would have got there eventually, I think.
A set of rules and specifications that allow different software systems to communicate and interact with one another. It acts as a middleman, enabling one application to request data or functionality from another without needing to know the internal workings of the other system. Now, this actually makes sense for him to say that they're, that he has to isolate their API.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense here.
The one thing.
Yeah, exactly. We just don't know what the VMO is.
Right.
And, you know, John, as we've mentioned numerous times, is not a tech person. So, you know, he's a little weary because he wants this to get done as quickly as possible.
Lost in translation.
Completely. And at this point, you know, he basically, as I said before, Farrell translates it back and says about 30 seconds. And he goes, not the easiest thing to do when, and we see Mai starting to stir. And, you know, John's not really paying attention to the fact that what's going on with Mai. He thinks she's completely out of it. Yeah. And then she comes in and starts charging at him. And then John picks up I think it looks like a box or something like that to try and block her. But then she just comes back and kicks him and he goes through the window.
I thought it was a monitor.
Is that a monitor? Because he lifts it up really easily. But a monitor would have, you'd think it would have been attached.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe so. It must have been one of the suitcase boxes they put
maybe
down.
Maybe it's a suitcase. Yeah, I think it's one of the suitcases, the suitcase computers. But she kicks him, and he falls down a few flights. It falls down like two flights, hits the air conditioning duct once again. Seems like a callback to a previous Die Hard movie. You know,
glass kinda everywhere.
Yeah, completely. And then, but luckily he lands on something and just rolls off and you know, finally hits the ground with the whole thing. And she's not too pleased with what Farrell's doing right now. And she walks back towards him and he's scared. He throws a punch at her and she grabs his arm.
Like immediately. Right. Just wraps him up.
And immediately he goes, okay. And then she goes, undo everything you just did. Now, okay. And then he says something really, really funny. Because she slams him into the computer a little bit. And then he goes, I'm a righty. I need my other hand. I really do. I'm a righty.
I really like that moment.
Yeah.
Because you never hear something about that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, what do you think the percentage is between the number of the percentage between people who are righties and people who are or right-handed and people who are left-handed?
I want to say, and these are just the first two numbers coming to my head, 86% right hand, 14% left hand.
It's actually 90-10.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And then they say there's about 1% that are ambidextrous, but this article that I read also that basically says that very few people are really ambidextrous. They're just people who are able to train their other hand to do things. Now, do you know what the official term is for the, you know, your dominant hand? There's an official term, which I'd never even heard of in my entire life.
I would have just assumed dominant hand. I didn't think there'd be something else for it.
It's called handedness.
Huh?
Yeah.
No, that sounds like someone made that up in the last 5 years.
I couldn't tell you when that was made up. But
handedness. Okay.
It is a biology term known as handedness. Is the individual's preferential use of one hand.
Hmm.
Due to and causing it to be stronger, faster, or more dexterous.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, right. Then you also have what's besides right-handedness, left-handedness, and ambidextry, you have mixed handiness or cross-dominance. And it's the change of the hand preference between different tasks. That's usually also close to 10% of the population, which means that certain people use one hand for one thing and the other hand for the other. You know, for like writing or for throwing a baseball, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, like I write with my right hand, but brush with my left hand or brush my teeth with my left hand, something like that. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Exactly. That makes sense.
Okay. Do you know when the International Left-Handers Day is?
Oh, I used to know this because I dated a girl in high school and she was left-handed. And as a joke, I would always give her candy on that day. But now it bothers me because I can't remember. I want to say, gosh, I want to say it's in like March or April, something like that.
Do you remember the time of year, the season maybe?
No, unfortunately not offhand, no.
Okay, so it's August 13th.
August 13th, all right, way off. Yeah. Way off, Nick.
Which was established in 1992.
Oh, okay, so relatively new.
Yeah, so it is an annual event where left-handers everywhere can celebrate their sinistrology, which is the official term for left-handedness, and increase public awareness of the advantages and disadvantages of being left-handed. It celebrates their uniqueness and differences, who are from 7 to 10% of the world's population. Thousands of left-handed people in today's society have to adapt to use right-handed tools and objects.
Hmm.
And apparently, there are more, proportionally, there are more left-handed people than the population in sports.
Really?
Yes.
Especially with baseball. Yeah, I can see baseball.
That's right. That's right. And baseball, there you know, you have people that you know, bat right and throw left, and vice versa, and things like that. So
yeah,
you know, that goes along with what we're seeing before. But people who do different tasks with different arms, and then you also have the people that can do with both. Then we see John, you know, groaning on the ground next to the guy from The Big Bang Theory. We see his body still lying there on the ground, which I like the continuity of it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that they actually let us see that, you know, they just left his body laying on the ground there.
Stark reality.
That's right. And then John looks around and sees the employee parking lot, which is, you know, important for him. He needs that.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, they give us a little clues as to what's going through John's head. You know, he sees a truck. And, you know, he starts limping over and passes another body that's on the ground and gets into a SUV and just backs it up and starts driving in it. You know, makes us think for a second that maybe he's fleeing the scene. But, you know, don't know what he's actually going to do. We know John's got a plan. We just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And then Mai gets a little impatient with Farrell. He cocks the gun and starts moving towards him. But Farrell then says, "One last door to open." And then he goes, "Do you know what you're doing?" You know, and then he says, "I mean, do you realize what this will do to the country?" "Yes, I do. Now open the door."
And he's just like, "Well, as long as you say you know."
That's right.
If you say so.
He's okay, good. Glad we're on the same page.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you think he's trying to distract her? Do you think or he's trying to buy himself time by the way he's doing this?
I think he's doing both. I think he's trying to stall. I think he's trying to buy time. I think he knows that, like, as soon as he's done, he's dead. So I think he's just trying to prolong that. So by any sense of a miracle or something, that he'll be saved.
Right. And then we get a shot of John driving up a ramp. Just going in circles, and Farrell continues to do the stuff, but we can start hearing in the background something going on.
Yeah, very faintly.
Yeah, and then Farrell says to her, "You do. I'm glad you know." And she's just looking at him, and you know, we see that there are now more reds than greens. So he's letting her continue to go back with it, and she raises the gun, getting ready to get rid of him. You can see that she realizes that he's done what she wants him to do. And then we hear the SUV, you know, barreling through, and John just drives through the wall, and you know, luckily he reaches the point where Mai is, just smashes right into her. And Farrell
really nails her.
Really? Seriously? And then she lands on the hood, holding on tightly. And then John looks at her and says, How you doing? Which is great. That's just a very typical John
yeah,
comment.
Little smart alecky.
Yeah. And you know, he's just driving through all these glass, and then he drives through a door. And you know, he doesn't really care about her. And then
No, not at all.
We get a shot of the second henchman hearing something, running to the side, and seeing this SUV just driving with Mai on the hood. And then he starts moving in that direction. And then John goes, "Hang on." And you can see the fear in Mai's face at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty serious.
Yeah, and then he jams through this wooden doorway. And I don't think John really thought this through himself.
No, not at all. He probably had zero idea what's on the other end there. He's just like, I'm going to run into a wall eventually.
That's right. And what he eventually is, he's in the elevator shaft. Again, yeah. Another callback to Die Hard, elevator shaft. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's in the elevator shaft slightly differently than he was last time. But, and we see she's hanging on, and she gets caught up in some of the ropes that are there. And the car, this SUV also gets caught into these ropes. And John is not in a comfortable position either. You know, he hasn't really done well for himself. And she's just hanging on. We see her trying to climb around as she's hanging on, trying not to fall. And then we get a great viewpoint from John down into this elevator shaft. You can see how far down it is.
Yeah.
Is a scary view. From both John and Mai's perspectives at this point. That's how this segment ends. You know, but then again, John's used to looking down elevator shafts like this, isn't he?
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah, he's like, ah, that's no big deal. The only difference is now he's in a car instead of... Yeah. So.
Nor is he inviting anyone to any parties.
No. No. No, not at all. And, yeah, so anything else you want to add?
I don't know how he keeps doing it. He's already coming into this injured and beat up from what he's already gone through earlier in the day. If I get hit with just one of those kicks, or I get kicked just through that window regardless and hit all the, I'm done for the rest of the day. I'm not getting back up. I'm not, I can't do that. And
lucky if it's just for the day.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd be like, sorry, man, that's it. Sorry, world. It's over. This is kind of the part in the film where it starts to take that turn and get away from a diehard film and just becomes a little over the top, like action film, almost like a James Bond type movie. I'm not denying that McClane wouldn't have training. He wouldn't have all these different things, but to have his body so trained and maintained to be able to take hits like these and just get up and keep moving, like it's, and I get it. It's a movie, right? It's make-believe. We're all just having fun here. But there's still a part of me that's just like, really? Like, could we have done something a little bit different? Could it have been something? Because when you look at the three previous films, there's not, in my mind, any like real over-the-top piece that isn't plausible, right? But this, it starts to become that just like, you know, what are we doing kind of thing.
That's right. Unbelievable. All right, so today's segment is it's called Franchise Fever, where my guests will give their top five movie franchises that have at least four entries in them. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
My number five is Planet of the Apes, and that is both the originals and the new movies, the reboots. Alien, it's number four. Number three is Godzilla. Number two is Star Wars. And number one is Muppets.
You Muppets? Come on.
Yeah, who'd have thought? Who would have thought?
Yeah, I was actually a little surprised that Todd didn't put that on his list.
I wonder if I almost didn't, but I'm like, you know what? No, it counts. It's a franchise. Not every film in a franchise has to continue the story that's being told. It can still be set within that universe. So that's what I'm doing.
Okay. And that's fair. Makes a lot of sense. All right. Excellent. And now we will play our daily game of State Your Motto. So today we are choosing West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So your choices are A, mountaineers are always free. B, agriculture and commerce. Or C, hard work conquers all things.
I want to say B, agriculture and commerce.
Nope. The answer is mountaineers are always free.
See, I thought that would have been too on the nose because of the West Virginia football team being the Mountaineers.
Okay, well, again, you have to think about it from the perspective that these are all real. You know, I didn't go and make up mottos. So
no, I know you didn't, but it's just like
I'm saying it's going to have to be one of the 50 states, and therefore, you know, if you're aware of the fact that it's the Mountaineers, so maybe, you know, that would have made sense. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, it's not you. It's me. I'm just sitting here. I think I'm making it too difficult on myself.
Maybe. Maybe sometimes the most obvious answer is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to look at it from that perspective too. All right, yeah. Excellent. So, Nick, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Nick Rehack?
Absolutely. They can find me over at rabbitholepodcasts.com. There are two programs that I'm on all the time, Lyrical Innuendo. That's Bubba Weed and myself. We take a song and we determine if it's about sex, drugs, or just good old-fashioned rock and roll. I'm also on the Play MST4Me podcast with Jason Soto. Jason Soto is a MST3K superfan. He is guiding me, and we're watching every single episode that show has ever made. We started at the very beginning, and as of this podcast, we are near-ish kind of the end of season two, and we'll be starting season three in another few weeks, less than a month. We'll start that. So that's going to be a whole lot of fun. So check those out, rabbitholepodcasts.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, Nick, you feel like coming back in tomorrow to talk about five more minutes of this movie and see what's going to happen in this? I don't know if we want to call it a cliffhanger or maybe call it a elevator shaft hanger.
It's a hanger regardless, and I got to figure out what happens.
Exactly. All right. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue, yeah. But it ain't me, it ain't me. I ain't no fortunate one.